All right, good morning. If we're ready, we'll go ahead and get started then. This is the administrative agenda A02-10, and present, I guess, in Carson City.
Rebecca Wagner.
And in Las Vegas.
Alita Birdshaw.
And I'm Sam Thompson. I understand that General Counsel has item one, but don't let me misspeak here, but are we actually going to hold that matter and move Executive Director's item 2A up first? Is that right, Ms. Jackson?
Chairman, yes, if you're okay with that, I'd like to take item 2A first.
Right, that'll be fine. Let's do that. And are there any objections by the other commissioners if we do that?
No.
Okay. So item 2A is a presentation by the Commission's Executive Director regarding the request from state and local government panel on renewable and efficient energy within the Nevada Renewable Energy and Efficiency Authority, for a legal counsel position and a technical writer position from the Public Utilities Commission pursuant to Senate Bill 358. Ms. Jackson?
Thank you, Chairman. Good morning. Senate Bill 358, passed by the 2009 legislature, provides for the Renewable Energy and Energy Efficiency Authority to request from the Public Utilities Commission assistance regarding the use of any resources of the Commission in general. As a result, the State and Local Government Panel on Renewable and Efficient Energy, through their chair, Dr. Hatice Getchell, has requested assistance from the Commission by way of staff members. As you may recall, Commissioners, the Commission has assisted the Energy Commissioner in the past. Specifically, regulatory operations staff provided some clerical and administrative assistance to the Energy Commissioner during the startup of the new authority until Dr. Getchell was able to hire an executive assistant. Additionally, various staff members have availed themselves to meet with Dr. Getchell and others to discuss the operations of the Public Utilities Commission, as well as our Utility Environmental Protection Act processes. The Commission also transferred $250,000, with an additional $250,000 to be transferred next fiscal year to assist with the funding of the new agency. The request before you today is specifically that of a legal counsel. The briefing memo also delineates a technical staff member, but after discussions with the panel members and Dr. Getchell this morning, they advised that the technical staff member is not needed at this time. They are exploring other opportunities and may return to the Commission in the future to request additional resources. With respect to the legal counsel, I understand that the duties will be to represent the panel at all meetings, which are currently held once a month. The meetings typically last 3 hours, depending on the matters on the agenda meeting notice. The council would need to be knowledgeable in administrative, Nevada's open meeting, and energy law in order to provide the legal advice to the panel during its meetings. The position may also be required to provide research and report on issues that may come up during panel meetings. The legal counsel would also aid the panel in drafting and adopting regulations for the management and government of the panel, represent the panel before the legislature and legislative commission as necessary, and review contracts. The panel has not yet applied for or received any grant funds to distribute by contract, so the time commitment for this duty is unknown and will vary on a case-by-case basis. The legal counsel is required until the Energy Commissioner has funding to hire in-house counsel. The legal counsel's work, other than when at panel meetings, would be done at the Commission office. The Commission has legal counsel in both General Counsel and Staff Counsel's offices. However, the Commission's current workload is considerable, and some consideration must be made to determine the boundaries of any legal assistance provided. General Counsel has advised that the rules of professional conduct apply and would bar a Commission lawyer working in the Office of General Counsel from representing both the panel and the Commission. Rule of Professional Conduct 1.7 bars representation if a conflict exists and states that a conflict of interest exists if, number one, the representation of one client will be directly adverse to another client. Number two, there is a significant risk that the representation of one or more clients will be materially limited by the lawyer's responsibilities to another client, a former client, or a third person, or by a personal interest of the lawyer. However, the rule does allow representation when a concurrent conflict exists if, number one, the lawyer reasonably believes that the lawyer will be able to provide competent and diligent representation to each affected client. Number two, the representation is not prohibited by law. Number three, the representation does not involve the assertion of a claim of one client against another client represented by the lawyer in the same litigation or other proceeding before a tribunal. And number four, each affected client gives informed consent confirmed in writing. General Counsel believes that these exclusions would apply, as a Commission attorney could provide adequate and competent representation to both offices, that there is a statute that allows the requested assistance, and there is no current litigation between the two parties. However, a Commission attorney would need to obtain informed consent, confirmed in writing, from the Commission and the Energy Commissioner before taking on duties for the panel or the panel chair. Luke Busby, Assistant General Counsel at the Commission, has volunteered to assist the panel and the panel chair if the Commission approves such assistance. Mr. Busby would be well suited for the position, as he has specific experience with legal issues that the panel may encounter, such as organizational issues or open meeting law issues. If the Commission determines that it is possible to provide legal services, I would recommend that the Commission agree to provide legal services pursuant to a specific number of hours. The panel has provided specific duties, and I have estimated the attorney would need to work no more than 10 hours a week. General Counsel has advised Mr. Busby is willing to work for 10 hours a week, and that this amount of time will not prohibit him from completing his duties at the Commission. General Counsel's office can monitor the panel's request for services to ensure the assistance is provided according to the structure the Commission establishes. Based on the information just provided, I recommend the Commission grant the panel's request to provide legal counsel, specifically Luke Busby, in the following manner. Number one, prior to the start of work, the assigned legal counsel will be required to obtain informed consent, confirmed in writing, both from the panel chair and the commissioners, allowing the attorney to represent both the panel chair, and the commission. Secondly, the assigned legal counsel should not be required to work more than 10 hours per week for the panel or the panel chair until such time the panel is able to obtain funding to hire an attorney. Lastly, the assigned counsel will be required to keep the commission, the panel, and the panel chair apprised of any conflict of interest issues which would require remedial action by the attorney, the Office of General Counsel, the panel, or the panel chair. I am available to answer any questions the Commission may have. Dr. Getchell is here and has a short presentation for you, and we also have panel members in the audience. Thank you.
All right. Well, Dr. Getchell, you want to go ahead and make your presentation? And welcome.
Thank you, Chairman Thompson, and the Commissioner Burtonshaw, and the Commissioner Wagner. And the presentation, the handout have in front of you is has an 11 slide. I'm just going to go through the first 6 slides. The rest of it is informational for you. And today, for the record, my name is Hatice Getchell, and I'm the Nevada Energy Commissioner. But today, I'm here representing the state and government, local government panel. I'm the chair of the panel. Today with me, Gus Nunez from the Public Works Board. He's the member of the panel, as well as he's vice chair of the panel, sitting next to me, and then Dr. Hilary Lopez from Housing Division, member of the panel, also Jason Crosby from Building and Grounds, and he's also panel member with me. And I believe we have one more member in Las Vegas in the audience, Mark Hobaika, representing the League of Cities, and a member of the panel as well. And having said that, if I take you to the handouts you have, basically this one is kind of summarizes who we are. Since we are a new entity, there are a lot of confusion around and what we do, what are our responsibilities are. And each page has two slides on it, and the second slide gives the information what gave us the authority and how we started, and because of the last session, what bill passed. So the Senate Bill 358 created the Renewable Energy, Energy Efficiency Authority and the Nevada Energy Commissioner position, and also set the duties. That bill was introduced on March 23, 2009 by the Senate Committee on Energy Infrastructure and Transportation by Senator Horsford and Senator Schneider. That was approved by the governor. It passed and approved by the governor on May 28, 2009. It became a Chapter 321. Also, simultaneously, Assembly Bill 522 was introduced, and with the AB 522, we got the funding for the Renewable Energy Authority, and also that bill set some duties for the Nevada Energy Commissioner as well as the Renewable Energy and Energy Efficiency Authority. Assembly Bill 522 was introduced on March 23, 2009, by the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Sponsor of the bill was mainly the Assemblywoman Kirkpatrick. It passed and through the process, and Governor signed that bill on May 30, 2009, and that became a Chapter 377. Governor appointed the Nevada Energy Commissioner in October 2009. The mission of the Renewable Energy Energy Efficiency Authority is develop and use of renewable energy resources and its infrastructure, mainly the transmission in Nevada. Also, to reduce the energy demand through conservation and more efficient use of energy. The goal is that Nevada should be the renewable energy and energy efficiency leader in the West. And how we're going to achieve that, and through this, we need to create a new energy economy, mainly the renewable energy, energy efficiency measures, which everybody is talking about it, not only in Nevada, whole nation is talking about new energy economy. And attracting and retaining large-scale renewable energy industries for long-term renewable energy economy. Also, making sure the clean energy and the renewable energy is affordable for small businesses and owners. Of course, since we're talking about energy, we are talking about energy security and independence as well. If I take you to the slide four on page two, that is our organizational chart for the Renewable Energy Energy Efficiency Authority. Nevada Energy Commissioner is the executive officer of the Nevada Renewable Energy Energy Efficiency Authority. This authority is made of two committees. The first one is the State and Local Government Panel. So we are here before you as panel. This panel has seven members besides the chair, representative from State Public Works Board, a representative from Housing Division, a representative from Building and Grounds, representative from Department of Wildlife, representative from Nevada Association of Counties, a representative from Nevada League of Cities, and a representative of Nevada Association of School Boards. We have another group which is called as a New Energy Industry Task Force. That one has eight members spelled out in the law, but we also appointed five advisor members. Those group has people from industry, geothermal, large solar, wind, distributed generation, an advisor from the energy efficiency equipment and installation industry, and a member from Nevada Electric Utility, a member from the environmental or public land organizations, a member from Nevada Labor Organization, as well as the Nevada Contractor Organization, and some advisor for certain seats. If I take you to the page 3 and slide 5, and just to give you the briefing about what is the goal of these two groups, specifically the state and local government panel on renewable and efficient energy, we are responsible to monitor viability and the progress of energy efficiency and renewable energy retrofit projects at public buildings and schools. Very specific, only for public buildings and schools. And also, we can apply for any available grants and accept any gifts, grants or donation to assist the panel in carrying out our duties. The panel is expected to be an expert group on these issues to the state and local government entities and also the elected officials. This group, specifically this group, very hands-on group, so we met twice, and the very first discussion we had, we wanted to overcome the barriers between the counties and cities or the different state entities and then have real projects, hands-on projects. So because of that, we had carried a conversation with the federal U.S. Department of Energy, and then they expressed an interest that if we come up some real good projects for Nevada, they are willing to work with us. Hence, and because of that, since we don't have any staff member, we come before you to request some help with the grant. And the other duties, legislatures expects us to come up some policy ideas. First, look into what we have in the book, what worked, what didn't work, and look in the regional best practices as well as the federal best practices, and then evaluate and suggest some policy ideas to the legislatures by October. That brought up the legal help. So, and just give you the briefing about who are the Energy Industry Task Force, because that group just met once. They have not expressed any help from the PUCN yet, but if I have to guess, they will in the future. And their duty is to promote the development of renewable energy and energy efficiency projects in Nevada. They can also apply any grants and accept any gifts, grants, or donation to assist them, similar to the panel. The task force will be expected to be an expert group on the development of renewable energy, energy efficiency projects to the state and the local government entities and the elected officials as well. And the other things I just want to mention, this is the duties of the authority, but there is a Nevada Energy Commissioner as well. Nevada Energy Commissioner has regulatory duties, which is separate than the authority. So I listed those things on the following pages for informational reason for you, and I'm not going to read it. And that's all my presentation. If you or any or the other commissioners have any question to me or the panel members, we will be happy to address it. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Dr. Getchell. Are there any questions or comments by any of the commissioners?
Chairman, I have some questions. And I'll direct these questions to Ms. Jackson. In your briefing memo on under the legal counsel section, it says legislative commission represent the panel before the legislature and the legislative commission as necessary. I just want to, just having prior experience of going before the legislature, I do not think our council should be the point of the spear. I think that Mr. Busby would be helpful to be there to explain regulations, but I don't think it should be his responsibility to represent the panel before the legislature. I think that that's the Energy Commissioner's job and the panel member's job to be there to answer the meat and potato questions, and that Mr. Busby would be there to help with any kind of legal issues. So I was hoping to clarify that, and perhaps the Energy Commissioner could, Dr. Getchell, you could respond to that. What did you have in mind for our legal counsel's representation at Legislative Commission?
Since that this group needs to first adopt a regulation for their management and the government, and we told the legal counsel when we go to defend this before the legislative commission, will be with us and explain the legal matters, what's in the regulation.
You answered it already. You said with us. You weren't expecting just to send Mr. Busby on his own.
No.
Okay. I just wanted to be sure, because that's a scary, can be a scary experience. I know from experience. And then the one question I had concern about, and I raised this to Mr. Busby, and I don't know if you've had a chance to think about it. What if there is an open meeting law complaint? Will you have to represent the panel? Will that fall back on the PUC to represent? Have you had a chance to sort that out or think that through at all?
Yes, Commissioner Wagner. And what I've also discussed this issue with my fellow members of General Counsel, Dave Noble in particular. And what I think the scope of representation that's outlined in the summary portion of the executive director's memo entails is that, first let me explain, there's two types of open meeting law complaints. There's complaints against the organization, and then there's complaints against the individual, and there's different penalties for each type of complaint. If the Attorney General were to determine and try and prosecute a claim against an individual on the panel for an open meeting law violation, I do not believe that would fall within the scope of representation outlined here. But if, let's say, a member of the public or the Attorney General tries to challenge a decision of the panel under the open meeting law, then arguably that would fall within the scope of the representation outlined in the summary, I believe.
Okay. And you're okay with doing that?
Yes, okay. Commissioner Wagner, with informed consent.
Of course.
Okay.
And then, Dr. Getchell, in your presentation on page 3, slide 5 at the top, you said one of the objectives or that you're going to or you're evaluating is policies, policy ideas, like best practices from regional and federal entities, and potentially taking suggestions to the legislators by October for bill draft ideas. The only reason why I raise this point is that the commission will be, we have to do our BDRs by like May 3rd, so we'll probably be having some policy discussion, and I just see that potentially could be an area, not necessarily of conflict, but just as more a heads up to you, Mr. Busby, that the panel probably will have more progressive policy ideas than what the commission may come up with, and that hopefully nothing that would conflict. I would like to think that our commission is progressive now, but I just that might be an area where we just have to be careful. So, and just recognizing as an employee of the PUC, you don't necessarily, or you may, be supportive of those policy ideas, but they may be in conflict with what we're proposing. So I just wanted you to just be careful and just as a heads up to the panel and to Dr. Getchell. So those are my only comments and questions.
Mr. Burtonshaw.
One of the recommendations is on the conclusion of page 1 that the signed legal counsel will be required to obtain informed consent confirmed in writing from both the panel chair and the commissioners, allowing the attorney to represent both the panel chair, and the commission. The question I have is more of a practical one. Who's going to draft that?
Commissioner Burke.
General counsel will draft that. What was your answer, Ms. Jackson? I said general counsel will draft it. I don't know what you said.
I had the same answer.
I've always found it's a good idea to agree with your attorneys. And Ms. Dr. Getchell, you're fine with General Counsel's office drafting your conformed consent, confirmed in writing from both the panel chair and the commissioners?
For the record, Hatice Getchell, yes, Commissioner Burtonshaw. I'm not a lawyer,
okay,
so
thank
I
you.
Don't have a lawyer.
Thank you.
Anything else? You know, and that's really a good question. The and let me just roll this back just a minute with apologies to all the parties. First of all, I'm sorry we had to wait a little bit past getting started at 10 o'clock. We had an agenda this morning that went a little bit longer than necessary. The reason that we're here doing this is because of our own statutory change within our agency, AB 510, which in short shrift actually removed the language of the chairman being the executive officer of this commission. I don't know that the law of unintended consequences really applies, but the consequences simply are now that rather than the chairman being the executive officer on our side of the river here, and simply making those decisions that we have to meet under the auspices of the open meeting law, and we have to have this matter presented to the full commission. So I wanted to explain to the members of the panel, primarily Dr. Getchell was ever present up to the legislature, so she knows the ramifications of all of this. But for those lay members of the community that are here serving on panels, thank you for doing that. But this is not an exercise that we're doing lightly. We're simply required by state law to have these open meeting law administrative agendas. This is only our second one, so we're learning our way. But you may or may not have a copy of our agenda in front of you, but you can see we have a whole spate of items that we have to consider that our executive director, Ms. Jackson, has brought to us, and we'll have this discussion and we'll vote. So we have to vote on any request, particularly as it regards to assets and allocation of resources. And so that's why we're here, and I wanted to just take a minute to explain that to those of you who may think, why are we here wasting time, air, and words? When the idea of the Renewable Energy Commissioner's Office first came up, I will plead guilty to this, but I actually testified there. Part of the bill originally was that the General Counsel's Office of the Public Utilities Commission actually be the attorney for that commission. And being a recovering attorney myself, I can just tell you there are a lot of problems in terms of conflicts of interest, and I identified a number of them, and I actually testified against that because we don't even have the Attorney General representing us over here, because the Attorney General's Office on Bureau of Consumer Protection represents a party before us. So we actually have our own in-house counsel. So I have some concerns that I hope do not come to fruition down the line in terms of lawyer conflict, because Mr. Busby is a fine attorney and he is licensed by the state of Nevada, and his license is a privilege which is granted to him by the state of Nevada and the Board of Professional Responsibility and the Nevada Bar Association. So I would never ask him, and I know you wouldn't either, to do anything that would put him in the crosshairs of that, but it's important that we recognize that the conflicts that we're talking about are Mr. Busby's to manage, because it is truly his law license and his career we're talking about, as well as the conflicts that we may be talking about inured to the detriment of both the panel, the Renewable Energy Commissioner's Office, as well as the PUC. So we want to avoid all of that. So I think that I really don't have any questions. I just have these comments to make. But I think with the advice of counsel through General Counsel's Office, and with the graciousness with which Ms. Cohen and Mr. Busby have come forward to carve out some time here at 10 hours a week, as long as we get these informed consent matters taken care of, that will suffice. And the General Counsel here, Ms. Cohen, will be monitoring this to make sure that there's nothing that comes up that could potentially be a conflict. And if that happens, then of course we'll have to address as it comes. But the real gravamen I took from Commissioner Burtenshaw's question it really goes to the point of General Counsel's Office here drafting the informed consent form that you'll sign, Dr. Getchell. So you'll have to be very, this is my full disclosure statement, but you'll have to be very careful and think about this and look at that document and make sure you know what you're saying and you enter into it voluntarily and knowingly. It's basically a waiver is what it is of any potential conflicts. And then we'll have to sign the same document. Usually in matters like this, your attorney would look at that document, our attorney would draft it and look at it, and we'd get that advice. But in this peculiar instance, we share this attorney. So just be aware that the very document you're signing, really the on informed consent, is being prepared by the general counsel's office, who is also providing you the attorney. So just want to make that disclosure so that we all understand. And that's really what I took from Commissioner Burtonshaw's question. I thought it's an excellent point, and it's one that begs to be talked about a little more than a little less, so that we all understand it. There's nothing wrong about it. There's nothing illegal, or as we used to say, immoral or fattening about it. But it's just something that if we do it, everybody needs to understand what we're doing. So I think the recommendation was to defer, I guess, the request with regard to technical staff, and simply act upon Ms. Jackson, your recommendation that we assign Mr. Busby in response to the request for legal assistance, and the provision would be conditioned by the three conditions that you've indicated at the bottom of your page under conclusion, that prior to start of work that the legal assigned counsel will be required to obtain that informed consent confirmed in writing by both parties, and that there would be a cap of 10 hours per week, and that the assigned counsel, Mr. Busby, will be required to keep the commission, the panel, and the panel chair apprised of any conflict of interest. And the only other comment I might make is that the temporal frame here under subsection 2 was until such time the panel is able to obtain funding to hire an attorney. And this is, and I hate to put you on the spot here, but you know, like I say, I'm a recovering lawyer, and when I see open-ended language like that, that always bothers me. And we really do want the Renewable Energy Commission and the panel to be successful. We support that. We've demonstrated that by time, resources, and our own money. So we've done that in the past, and we'll continue to do that. But I think it's fair to say or to ask, what time frame do you anticipate, Dr. Getchell? I don't want to be sitting here 5 years from now asking that question, so it's better to ask it now.
For the record, Hatice Getchell, thank you for your question, Chairman Thompson. I want to mention one thing I forgot to mention. We don't have a Deputy Attorney General in the Attorney General's office. They structure this office just like PUCN. We should be able to hire a general counsel, but because of the budget condition, we do not have the money to hire a general counsel. And again, this is the panel's request. It's not the Nevada Energy Commissioner's request, because Nevada Energy Commissioner has her duties, and because of that duties, Governor's office assigned their general counsel to me for the Nevada Energy Commissioner's duties. For example, the renewable energy tax abatement issues, and time to time I go to her and I consult with her. And if it is, she was going to be here today, but she's traveling, unfortunately. And in fact, she has involved with the communication with Ms. Jackson when we were communicating what are our needs. And when your general counsel draft this, I can take this to her. She can take a look at it, and then maybe we can sign. And that's the first part of it. Second part, if I can take you to my last page of my presentation, which I didn't present, on page 6, if you look at the table, says duties under number 12, it talks about the Renewable Energy Fund. Eventually, this authority going to administer such a fund, this fund is going to be accumulated from the property tax abatement going to be abated to the renewable energy industry. Portion of this fund in this biennium, 20% is going to the general fund, 25% is going to local government, and the 55% is abated to the applicants. This is a property portion of the abatement. And after this biennium, 20% currently going to the general fund will be accumulated in the renewable energy fund. when this fund accumulates, 75% of that fund will be used to offset the ratepayer's rate if that ratepayer's rate is increasing because of the renewable energy development. The rest of the 25% will fund the authority. Currently, this fund hasn't been created yet. We have no funding yet because we have not given any abatement yet. As the abatements given for the eligible applicants, this fund will resume, and then we will eventually hire on staff. Unfortunately, I don't have a date. I wish I do. Considering I don't have any money, I don't know how to answer your question. But that will be the mechanism, basically. Eventually hire...
I think that did answer it, and I appreciate that. And that's just my omission in not reading that last page there under subsection 12. But what it tells me is that there is an end game, there is a mechanism for the funding to come in so that you can, so the panel can hire their own counsel. And that's really what I'm looking for, not a hard date. But, you know, I didn't want to just offer up Mr. Busby as an indentured service ad infinitum. But we know that at some point the funds will be forthcoming. And certainly under your guidance and auspices, the panel will be moving forward with regard to creating the abatements and creating that fund within which to use for the purpose of getting your own counsel. So I'm satisfied with that answer, and thank you for that. Are there any more questions or comments by commissioners? Okay. As I say, we're learning our way here, so I guess the matter before us then is the executive director's recommendation to accept her proposal as modified by the omission of the technical staff, and to grant the request by Dr. Getchell. Did I say that right, Ms. Cohen? Okay, close enough.
I think it's close enough with the provisions outlined by the executive director. Yes. But she was clear with that.
Yeah, so. With those conditions and provisions outlined by the executive director with regard to Mr. Busby's participation. So that's my motion, and I hereby make it.
And I hereby second it.
I concur.
Okay. All right. So done. All right. Thank you, Dr. Getchell, and thank you to all members of the panel. I appreciate your time and your patience for today. Thank you. Okay. And then going back then to General Counsel's item one. Are you going to present Mr. Busby?
Yes, Chairman. Item 1A is General Counsel's recommended strategy for addressing legislative issues during the next session. We just wanted to provide a concise skeleton outline of procedures the Commission could follow for the next session to allow an open Commission discussion of the topics. We recommend the following timelines and processes. We'd like to receive bill draft request submissions from each department by Friday, April 9th. We'd like them in the executive branch bill draft request form, which we will distribute after the meeting if the commission...
Actually, it's been distributed.
Okay.
Mr. Busby. Everyone should have that already.
General Counsel will review each BDR submission for accuracy and completeness and will coordinate with submitters to clear up discrepancies. We recommend the Commission hold an agenda on April 14th. I believe that administrative agenda has been rescheduled for April 20th. General Counsel will place each BDR submission on the agenda for the Commission's consideration. If the Commission identifies problems with the BDR request at this meeting, we recommend that the Commission hold shortly thereafter another meeting at which the Commission could address the issues. The Department of Administration has requested that all requests be submitted by May 3rd, 2010, so I think the Commission would have to hold a meeting to give General Counsel sufficient time to fix any problems that the Commission would identify with any BDRs. We recommend that the Commission assign each approved BDR to a commissioner, a department head, or to GC, who will be responsible for the BDR and the resulting bill before the legislature. And each person responsible for the bill should communicate and coordinate with the executive director and GC regarding changes made during the course of the legislative process. That way, if general counsel determines that an issue should be heard by the full commission again, we can bring it to your attention, either GC or the executive director. And that's it for now. I'm sure you guys have lots of issues and changes. So if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them. Thank you.
You know, just one quick, and it's really more of an observation, but we had thought about changing that administrative agenda as well as the utility agenda from the 14th to the 20th, but in so doing, you truncate your time before the BDRs have to be submitted to the Department of Administration. So after we have the agenda on the 20th, which will have to be noticed, we've only got 13 days before they have to be submitted, and so if we identify problems with that, we may not have enough time to notice and get back together. That's all. That's the only observation I want to make. That really compresses that time. The 20th may be our only bite at the apple prior to submission, and if there's a problem with it, rather than being able to address it, we may just have to not submit it as part of the package. I don't know.
Well, I would, excuse me, Chairman, recommend that. Because I think some commissioners are working on a lot of these BDRs right now, and in order to hopefully not necessitate another agenda, if you would be working with us as these are drafted, then it should be easier to, because we're going to have a detailed, it would be each bill draft request. Well, it's submitted to the executive branch or to the Department of Administration is just the bill draft request that has been provided to all of the commission AAs and to the commissioners. And then the actual language of the statute is not necessary at that time, because then the Department of Administration and the governor's office looks at these, makes a decision as to which ones they want to go forward with, and maybe would contact us as to which ones they think may or may not be important. So hopefully just getting this form right now, And having the intent behind what the bill would be, is what everyone should be thinking about. And by the way, I wanted to let you know that I did contact the AG's office, and they have orally approved this format to go forward with the legislature and not violate the open meeting law.
Okay. So on the 20th, when we get together to consider the BDR list that will be submitted, we're really going to be primarily looking at the caption of the bill and the intent of the bill, without the specific language. So if we need to get together and hammer out more language, if there's any kind of disagreement, we can do that even after May 3rd.
Yes.
Okay. Makes me feel much better. Thank you. That was just a question observation. Any other questions, comments?
Mr. Busby, when he was explaining the last bullet point about each person being responsible for each bill, coordinating with the executive director and general counsel, could he explain that again? He said something there that I'm not sure that I understood.
In general counsel's office, we had a discussion about what would happen if radical changes were to happen to a bill draft that the commission submitted to the legislature, where what the commission agreed on submitting had changed materially. And under those circumstances, we thought that it would be appropriate for GC's office and for the executive director to be aware of those changes. And if we felt that the full commission should address the issue again, we could bring it to the commission's attention. Ms. Cohen, I believe that was our conclusion.
Well, yes, because we're trying to address the problem that comes up during each session with changes that occur at the last minute, things that happen quickly, hearings that happen quickly. So the each person, let's say Commissioner Burton saw you had a bill that you were monitoring, you'd be responsible for that bill. But if it radically changed from what everyone had agreed with, if you notified one of us, we could then, you know, make the appropriate arrangements to perhaps reconsider or look at, so that the representation by the whole being able to say the commission supports this might change. That's, I think, what you're getting at, isn't it, Luke?
That is correct, Ms. Cohen.
Okay.
Okey-doke.
And I guess then on the 20th, when we get together, once we have a list of BDRs that we're approving and sending over, perhaps at that time, is it general counsel's recommendation or idea that we would divvy those up, that we would somehow decide whoever's supporting that bill would sort of be the point person?
I would think at that point, because right now, the way the bill drafts are going, certain commissioners have certain bill drafts that they're interested in. Staff has submitted a list of ideas, and those would be handled. My assumption would be that staff's going to be pretty, Anne-Marie is going to be pretty involved in the process also. And yes, at that point, they could be designated for whomever has been working on them, whoever has an interest in taking it forward, whoever wants to handle those particular bills. And if someone thinks that it's a legal issue that needs to be handled by GC, we can do that. And then certain budgetary bills would be handled by the executive director. But those are due later. The budget bills are due later than May 3rd. So we wouldn't be considering those on the 20th. Okay.
So on the 20th, would we be, once we take a look at the bill draft forms that will be submitted on April 9th, are we contemplating on April 20th divvying up the responsibility at that stage, or just discussing the process?
You know, actually, that's a good point, Commissioner. So I need to reconsider. we probably need to wait until the governor's made a decision as to which bills are going to go forward and then allocate them. Otherwise, we're putting the cart before the horse.
Okay.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Very good point, Commissioner. Thank you.
That's exactly my next question / point is that, yeah, you know, we're only allocated so many BDRs, and we don't know, you know, we can send a spate of them over to the governor's office, and none of them may make the program, so we just don't know.
True.
Commissioner Wagner?
Yeah, I have a couple of questions. In reviewing this briefing memo, Mr. Busby, the executive director, are you envisioning the executive director having the ability to come up with bill draft requests? Because I think as the administrator of the agency, that would be her responsibility, that if there needs to be anything changed administratively, that it should or can come from the executive director. Were you guys envisioning that the executive director would have BDRs?
If I understand the question correctly, Commissioner Wagner, are you asking whether the executive director can proceed with bill draft requests without commission approval?
No.
Okay.
What I'm asking is, staff has been given the opportunity to provide bill draft requests. The commissioners have. I would assume most of ours will go along the lines of policy because that's what we're here for. Administrative issues, I know that some little tweaks to the language have come up in previous discussion. Those are administrative issues. Is the executive director entitled to provide her own BDRs subject to commission approval?
Subject to Ms. Cohen's approval, I believe the answer is yes.
Okay.
No, it's subject to commission approval, Mr. Busby.
So, Jan, you're saying
the executive director does have the ability, Commissioner, yes, and with administrative matters and with budgetary matters to submit BDRs to through us if necessary, but there are different timelines for different kinds of bills, and these bills, the policy issues, have a different timeline than the budgetary issues. But, of course, if she has bills that she'd like to submit, she has every right to submit them.
Okay, because the only reason why I say that is that nowhere in here does your briefing memo say it. It says each department, and so I would take that or you, commissioner, department head, or general counsel. I would then, in my mind, think that department head is executive director when it comes to administrative issues. Okay, I just wanted to clarify that. And so when we go forward to vote on these, it'll be more conceptual, more along the lines of the little captions. Hopefully we won't be as vague as legislators, like provide changes to NRS 704. I'm anticipating that we'll have each of us that brings forward something that will have a little bit more discussion than that. Is that what you envision, Ms. Cohen?
Yes, and that's why we provided. In fact, Darcy Hayden is going to be the point person too, just so all of you will know. when we deal with the Department of Administration, but any one of us, obviously, too. I mean, I know that Mr. Busby's working with some of these bills specifically as to language, and some of the commission AAs are working with their commissioners, you know, as to language. So hopefully, what I'm emphasizing is if they're specific enough and clear enough as to the intent and what needs to be done with the bill draft request initially, they'll be fine. And we'll just be able to submit them to you, and you can vote on them, and then they can go directly to the Department of Administration.
Okay, and then to further clarify a point made by Chairman Thompson, we'll have another bite at the apple as these develop, because I'm just afraid if we're, as we go along, right now we're coming up with captions and general concepts. Say 3 months from now, we realize, wait a second, maybe this is taking a direction that we weren't comfortable with. The commission will have the opportunity to revisit any of our bill draft requests.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I think that's what Mr. Busby meant by his last paragraph when he was talking about the procedure.
I just wanted to hit that point like five more times just to be clear. Thanks.
I expect we're going to have a long agenda meeting on the 20th to discuss what we're looking at. But just as a caveat, I know we all know this, but it's better to say it, you know, we have to be careful, too, in just drafting captions for bills that the body actually doesn't fit. So you know, I just say that because, you know, that's going to be the death knell of that bill. If we get a caption that's not broad enough or it's different from what the language actually, so we do have to sort of work to tailor the language, even though we may have another bite at the apple, we're going to be pretty much bound by the captions we come up on the 20th. So,
well, right. let me throw this out there, and I'm a recovering attorney as well, but the list the staff has provided to us, Mr. Young, Mr. Shiraz, and Mr. Busby, and I have been working our way through that list. And at this stage, we do have the BDR forms principally filled out. I think we need to work on those a little bit more. But what has been really focused on and finished is the actual languages, changes to the statutory language. We could submit those on the 20th for people to start taking a look at. To me, when I take a look at the BDR form and I see what I write there, it really helps me to see what the statutory language looks like. I know they're not necessary by April 9th or for the April 20th agenda, but if there's a desire or an appetite to see that as well, like, we can certainly submit that with at least that list the staff has given us.
You're working off the email from the DRO?
Yes.
Okay.
And Commissioner Burtenshaw, I think that's a really good idea because there's a couple of things that overlap on staff's recommendations and what I was putting together. And what I was going to try to do, just to make sure you guys were fully informed of what was going on in my little pea brain, was to have maybe not necessarily a written briefing memo, but the ability to explain where I'm headed and why I'm headed there and what the policy change is and the intent, so that you're not just blindly being sucked into changes to 701B pursuant to the solar energy program or something along those lines. I want to be able to provide you with a little more guidance than that. So, and perhaps even language, if I can get through that by next Friday.
And yeah, one last thought. I know none of us feel this way, like, you know, this is some sort of star chamber backroom proceeding where all the people with titles get together and we get to decide what the BDRs are. Because quite frankly, in my humble experience, most of the people that really know what needs to be changed are actually on the front lines doing the work, and they're probably going to know as much or better than any of us. So I just want to just encourage anyone to think about this. The only thing I would ask is that they work within their department, their respective divisions, so to avoid, you know, a duplication or things that may be addressed. We don't want to just get flooded with these things to where we can't get through an agenda on the 20th with them, because that is going to be a filtering process there. But prior to that, if people have ideas, in as much as we got an email from the DRO with just a bullet point list of things that Commissioner Burtenshaw has started working on, you know, there may be others that ideas that are out there. If they, and I just encourage those individuals to go to their individual department head, their supervisor, with their ideas, and also encourage those managers and supervisors to work with them. And where it's not a duplication and where it's an idea that could be supported, that gets moved up to the agenda level. So that we just don't have the department heads and the supervisors coming up with BDRs in the absence of those who actually have to deal with the laws that we're hoping to create every day. So that's just kind of a little proselytizing there. But I thought it'd be better to say that so people would understand they absolutely do have a right to submit their BDRs to their respective superiors and have it looked at and vetted and filtered up.
And there's one more comment I just wanted to make is last legislative session we didn't have any BDRs, so we're a little rusty on this whole process, plus we have this new process. Under Governor Gwynn's administration, I believe the governor's office limited agency requests to 5 BDRs. So I know that we have a boatload of BDRs or concepts floating around. I think some of them ultimately will be combined, and I recall Governor Gwynn's counsel making that recommendation, like, can't you lump these two things together because they're close enough? But just keep in mind that we might end up having to prioritize ultimately what our ideal and best BDRs to carry forward are if we can't combine them. So, of course, I have a million ideas. I'm not going to subject you all to that. I'm sure other people will figure out where I think policy should go, and they can take that up. But the few key things that I complain about in every rulemaking process, I'm going to take a stab at fixing those. But I just wanted to put it out there that we could end up being limited on our BDRs.
Yeah, that's really an excellent point. And I, you know, just as the Assembly and the Senate does with regard to their ABs and SBs, you know, they cover half a dozen statutes. Well, if we can find those statutes or those areas where we need to make changes that are similar in nature, we can put more than one under a BDR, and we'll have to work to do that. But that's really work for the 20th. I know that. So, any other comments or questions before we vote? Then, I guess the motion then would be to accept with the any modifications that we've discussed here on the record, the executive director's, the general counsel's recommendation with regard to the process and strategy for addressing legislative issues and discussion of matters before the 2011 legislative session.
Was that a motion?
I think so.
Okay. And understanding that the modification to General Counsel's briefing memo was the change of date on April 14th to April 20th?
Right.
Okay. Second?
Right. Concur.
Okay. Next item, Ms. Jackson, is, was it?
2B.
I guess it's 2B, right? Or not 2B?
That is the question.
Thank you, Chairman. The Northern Nevada Water Planning Commission is a technical advisory commission to the Western Regional Water Commission. They're made up of directors and general managers of member utilities and water resource experts to represent key stakeholders. And the Western Regional Water Commission is composed of a board of trustees of elected officials from member agencies. Back sometime around June 2008, Dave Noble, our assistant general counsel and hearing officer, was designated as the commission's representative for the Northern Nevada Water Planning Commission. It is my understanding that Mr. Noble's role was only to attend their agenda meetings, which are regularly held once a month. He would observe from the audience. He wasn't a voting or participating member. Mr. Noble also indicated that during the meetings he attended, there really weren't any issues addressed by that commission that impacted the PUC's interests. And as a result, Mr. Noble has not attended subsequent meetings and has requested that if the commission wants representation, that someone else be designated. I would recommend that I notify the Northern Nevada Water Planning Commission and let them know that we won't be sending a representative to their monthly meetings, However, we will provide them with a contact person. I'm recommending that be Mark Clarkson, our manager of policy analysis. Mr. Clarkson can review their monthly agenda meetings in the event there's an item agendized that would impact the commission's interest. He could attend the meeting. Otherwise, and in the event he did attend a meeting, he could provide feedback to the commission. Otherwise, he would be an available resource in the event they make a request of the commission.
Crystal, is Mr. Noble there?
He is coming forward, Commissioner.
Morning.
Good morning. So, what kind of entities make up the Northern Nevada Water Planning Commission?
There are representatives, essentially they are in the Truckee Meadows area, and let me...
I can maybe add some, Commissioner. The member agencies are the City of Sparks, the City of Reno, the Sun Valley General Improvement District, and the other icon is too small for me to read. Truckee Meadows, it looks like. Truckee Meadows, GID, General Improvement District.
Yeah, also a general manager for Truckee Meadows Wastewater Reclamation. A board member to represent the environmental, biological, and conservation or public concerns. A member appointed by the board to represent owners of domestic wells. A member appointed by the board of supervisors of Washoe Story Conservation District or its successor. Those are the voting members, and then non-voting members are the PUC, the BCP, a member appointed by the state engineer, another member appointed by the chief of the water planning section of the Division of Water Resources. And so those are generally, in a nutshell, who are on the board.
And is anybody in this group an entity that we regulate?
No.
Tell me a little bit more about the member of the board who's dealing with domestic wells.
It just says one member appointed by the board to represent owners of domestic wells. So I believe it's essentially somebody who has a domestic well or is part of the, if there's a body. I can get that information to you who that specific member is.
Okay. Well, I guess what I'm wondering more actually is the Northern Nevada Water Planning Commission, would you suspect that would include Nye County or any portion of Nye County?
No.
Okay, thank you.
When was the board created? And with specificity, what I'm asking is, did we have a representative before you, Mr. Noble, or were you the first one?
SB 487 that was passed during the 2007 legislature is what created the Northern Nevada Water Planning Commission. I believe there was a successor or a previous committee before that, but the 2007 was when the Northern Nevada Water Planning Commission was created, and there was.
And since then, you've been a non-voting representative on that, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Why do they have us designated as a, even though a non-voting member, a member at all?
That's a question that I went through the legislative history of SB 487 to figure that out, and I couldn't. Couldn't glean from that why we were on there, except that we regulate water and sewer utilities, and they thought we might be able to add something. My experience was, though, that they were dealing with specific matters to Truckee Meadows that didn't touch upon our regulation of water and wastewater utilities in the area.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Comments? Okay, then I guess the motion would be then to accept the executive director's recommendation regarding a request by the Northern Nevada Water Planning Commission for a commission representative, and that would be Mr. Clarkson under the conditions described in the briefing report. That's my motion.
Second.
Concur.
Okay. Item 2C.
Item 2C deals with some logo ideas for your consideration. Our public education and information officer has provided 5 different logo ideas. The logos may be used for correspondence that would relate to our consumer outreach activities as well as public education and information activities, and anything else deemed appropriate by the commission or the executive director. The use of a PUCN logo does not replace or preclude the use of the state seal, but it will provide some benefits. One is it will facilitate awareness and recognition of the PUCN and its mission. It can also discourage negative connotations in the public mind regarding the independent nature of the PUCN and its separateness from the utilities it regulates. It can assist the PUCN in standing out among countless demands on public attention. And I've listed some of the other state agencies that use a logo other than the state logo, and also some other utility commissions throughout the state or throughout the United States. It can also provide consistency in graphic images used to promote our agency and its mission. And it can also benefit the morale among employees of the commission. The logos were developed at no cost to the commission through a contact obtained by the public education and information officer. If one of the logos is approved by the commission, final versions of the artwork will be provided along with a signed release form releasing the logo for unlimited use to the PUCN at its discretion. If you'll turn to the 5 pages that contain the logos, the first logo, and hopefully you have the colored printouts of these, the first logo is a traditional state-oriented logo. It's, you know, kind of the blue with the PUCN and the Nevada. The second logo has more of a green feel to it. It's considering the current culture and the type of energy innovations being advertised and encouraged. It also has a motion identifier reflective of how energy technology and innovation is always moving and changing. By nature of regulating utilities, the PUCN also has to be moving and changing to accommodate the technology. Logo number 3 is, again, more of the traditional look. It does include the outline of the state. The colors are more of the earthy, renewable feel colors as opposed to the blue and silver, as in logo 1 demonstrates. Logo number 4 has a little person in the center representing, you know, public nature along with a representation of the regulation of telecommunications. The colors in the circles are there to represent the various utilities that we regulate, such as yellow for electricity, orange for natural gas and safety, blue for water, and green for renewable. This logo attempts to pull elements from all the previous logos into one identifier, and the icon portion is designed so that it can stand alone if necessary and work in conjunction with the acronym with the name spelled out. Logo number 5 is pretty much the same as logo number 4. It's missing the N for Nevada and just has the shape of Nevada to be used for the N. So those are for your consideration. If you'd like to choose one, we can then begin using these on, you know, various consumer outreach activities and public information activities.
It's open for discussion, I know, but is it your intent to only use these, like, for, I guess, brochures for consumer sessions and public outreach and things of that nature, as opposed to, we're not talking about replacing this on our stationery or our signage or anything like that.
We are not. This would be used in addition to, and as you just suggested, with respect to some of our consumer outreach, our brochures and some flyers. We could also use it in the event we wanted to have some polo shirts or coffee mugs or something of that nature done for employees.
Great. 2XL. Ms. Jackson, you remember that in dealing with Rick Day over at Buildings and Grounds on the signage issue on that monument signing of the proposed new building, he indicated to us that they did some artwork and he was going to have to send it somewhere for approval. It was another state agency. Do you remember that? Do you remember where he was going to have to send that? I'm just wondering if there's some application here, because we looked at monument signage on that outside building at the Lepore building, and I remember Rick indicating to us by email that he would have to submit that for approval. And I just want to make sure that we do the same thing here, if that's in fact what we have to do.
Yeah, Chairman, I'm not aware of any additional approvals that we would need for this logo, but I would certainly check to be certain there isn't any other requirements that we would need to fulfill before using this. And I would probably check with some of the other state agencies. Department of Transportation is currently using their own logo.
Right. I don't think it's prohibited, but I know Ms. Skull, I know there were some emails between Rick and Donna and I at some point indicating the different signage issues and that he would have to get that approved. So I just want to make that comment that we'd probably have to go through a hoop to get it approved, not that that's really a problem.
Yeah, and I think that was more with respect to perhaps maybe the city ordinance or something of that nature with respect to signage. I don't think it was an actual logo, an internal logo, but I will definitely check on that.
Okay. That's the only question I've got. Any other questions or comments?
Ms. Jackson, has the Public Education Information Officer and the PIA and the Public Information Officer, have they weighed in on what they think would be the preferred one?
I did speak with the Public Education and Information Officer, and I believe her selection was logo number 2. And I have not talked with the Consumer Outreach Director.
Is Mr. Stover in?
Yeah. We're going to get Mr. Stover to come back in the room. And while we're waiting, just to make sure I have this correct, because free is great, and I understand it that what we have here is cost-free design work given to us, and that if we pick one of these, that the final design work will be given to us, and along with a license to use it in any way we see fit forever. We own it, is that right?
That is my understanding, Chairman, and I would work through General Counsel's office to ensure that we get the appropriate signed release releasing, the graphics accordingly.
Whoever's doing this is a very gracious offer, and I appreciate it. However, having been an old intellectual property lawyer, there are trademark and trade name issues to think about here, too. So whoever's giving us this, we have to make sure this isn't something that's being used by somebody else somewhere else and completely unintended, and we start using it, and the next thing we know, we get a cease and desist letter because we're using it. And, there may be a Power Uniform Company of Nebraska or something. Who knows? Don't you love the fact that I have no answers but just questions? But the truth of the matter is that we would not want to run afoul of that. So,
Mr. Stover, I think I'm informed he's not here.
I would be happy to check with him. I think Stephanie Herrera is in the audience, and she is holding up the number 2 signal. So apparently. Mr. Stover has weighed in as well for a vote on logo number 2.
Well, let me tell you why I like logo number 1.
You noticed I didn't provide a recommendation on this matter.
Right. It's much more simple. And frankly, it looks more like the logo we were going to put on the building at Lepore. So I think to be, at least in the Las Vegas area, more to identification.
I actually like local number one for a state agency that has kind of a boring scope of work, for lack of a better term. Plus, the other stuff, I actually really like those. As a former PR person, I like the other ones, but I also think the more conservative is more representative of boring old or boring regulators. I wouldn't want to call any of us old. And it kind of looks like University of Nevada logo, so, you know, I have a little soft spot for it there.
Maybe we could add a little mascot onto the Nevada.
You know, a wolf. I don't want to be overreaching here, but do you think they would give us two? Because, you know, I mean, you don't ask, you don't get, as they tell me. But I actually think number one is probably more applicable for a state agency. But I don't want to appear just like we're old staid stick in the mud, because there may be occasions when that number two, which I really do like a lot, could really be used. But I mean, if we're only going to get one, I like number one. But we may be overreaching.
I think Ms. Herrera could use her fine negotiating skills and negotiate two. I guess the question would be, when we would use which logo and who would make that decision.
We can write a policy for that. Well,
I think we might defeat the purpose if we have two of them. I think they're meant for identification purposes, but
yeah, of course you have the same question about which logo to use too. And who's going to make that decision with regard to our official logo or the one we get? So that sort of begs the question, really. And in that regard, since we're talking about using it for consumer outreach and things of that nature, I would defer to Ms. Herrera and Mr. Stover and to their supervisors as to when to use this, the whatever logo we adopt as opposed to the official logo. I think they're the ones that are. And that's why I think number one, at least for me, it's a safe bet, because if we use logo number one as opposed to the official state seal, we haven't departed so radically that we could be criticized or anything for it. So it's that would be my suggestion, is that we go with number one.
I would agree with going with the plain old boring number one, because okay. Of the nature of our business.
We're just plain old boring people here, I know, but. All right. Well, let me go ahead and just make the motion then that we adopt logo. That we adopt the recommendation of the executive director and request that logo number one be the one.
Actually, the executive director refused to give a recommendation. So, I'm going on your motion.
I need to step into that.
All right. Yeah. Okay. Well, then, in the omission of our executive director's recommendation, then I recommend that we and move that we adopt logo number one with gratitude to whoever is providing it for us.
And I'll second that, saying I think that they are all good, but number one, I think, is best suited for us.
Yeah. I concur.
Thank you. Okay. And if it's any consolation, my choice was number one.
You know, and you know, just really, and just as a matter of just civility, maybe we should, I don't know, I'm happy to send a letter thanking these people, but maybe Ms. Herrera would like to, or Ms. Jackson, but we certainly ought to recognize whoever is doing this. I'm sure it's a design firm or somebody. I just think it's a wonderful gesture, and we need to let them know we appreciate that.
I'm certain that Ms. Herrera will properly thank the designer behind this. I see her in the back of the room.
Okay. All right. Let's see. 2D then, Ms. Jackson.
Okay. 2D. This matter is involving the executive order recently issued by Governor Gibbons establishing innovative work schedules. On March 15th, 2010, Governor Gibbons issued an executive order establishing innovative work schedules. There should be a copy attached to your briefing memo. That may improve efficiency, decrease costs to employees and the state, and improve employee morale. The executive order encourages directors to implement innovative work schedules that will decrease employee commuting costs and save on energy consumption while meeting workload demands and client services. Agencies wishing to adopt innovative work schedules are required to comply with NRS 281.110 sub 1. If the innovative work schedule includes an office or division closure, it is necessary to provide the justification to the Executive Budget Office for approval. In the event they approve it, they will provide it to the Governor's Office for final approval. Additionally, on March 24th, I attended a meeting held by state personnel to discuss the application of the governor's executive order. State personnel indicated that if an agency or division implements an innovative work week, that the agency director must have consent from the majority of affected employees. Clarification was provided regarding how furlough leave would work with a 4-10-hour work week. Classified employees may take their furlough leave in increments less than 8 hours, which is consistent with the Commission's current furlough leave policy. Unclassified employees would still report as an exception reporter during furlough week. However, both classified and unclassified employees would need to take an additional 2 hours of annual leave, leave without pay, or work 2 additional hours during their furlough week to cover the difference between the 8 hours of furlough and the 10-hour workday. Holiday weeks would be subject to the same process as employees are only entitled up to 8 hours of holiday pay. Division managers and section supervisors were asked to analyze and discuss the possibility of implementing innovative work schedules with their staff and report their recommendations to the Commission Secretary. The information received supports maintaining the traditional 8-to-5 Monday through Friday 5-day work week. More specifically, each of the divisions provided justification for the traditional work week. General Counsel's Office, the Utility Hearings Officer, and the Administrative Attorneys gave a page and a half of reasons delineating why the traditional work week needs to remain. They documented statutory and regulatory timeline issues with respect to rate cases and, you know, various other cases before the Commission. There's litigation and scheduling obligations that need to be considered. There's filing and document review that have statutory requirements. And there's also FERC monitoring and litigation that are of concern. The Policy Analysis Division indicated that they are providing a service to commissioners and hearing officers, and that their division could essentially accommodate whatever work week the Commission were to approve. The Engineering Division, the operators that are jurisdictional to the Pipeline Safety Program, they basically operate their systems 24/7. However, they only perform new construction and maintenance work on a 5-day business week. They are on call 24/7, but inspect construction and maintenance work on the same 5-day business week as operators. It is conceivable that deviation from the 5-day work week could be interpreted as reducing the effectiveness of the program and may possibly have a negative effect on the federal grants they receive to include funding. Staff Counsel's Division has indicated that in order to meet their workload processing, it is necessary that they be available Monday through Friday, 8 hours per day. Financial Analysts and Resource and Market Analysis Divisions, same thing. They think it would be burdensome for a small water utility to be expected to allow a staff auditor to remain on their premises auditing their records for a 10-hour day, when the utility itself does not have staffing to supervise the audit for a 10-hour day. That's just one example that they gave. The Rail Safety Division, essentially the rail safety inspectors are flexible and could accommodate either a 4-day, 10-hour work week or a traditional work week. Consumer Complaint Resolution, they believe there would be a serious impact to customers if they weren't available 1 day a week. especially in circumstances where electric or gas services are turned off. Administration basically has suggested they're a support service. They provide support to the other divisions just discussed. They could technically accommodate either work week schedule. With respect to utility costs, by closing one day a week, there really isn't any recognizable savings. Our lease is all inclusive, and we pay a flat utility cost regardless of our usage. So basically, in conclusion, I would recommend that at this time we remain on our current five-day work week schedule. Business as usual, Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, with the exception of legal holidays. However, I would ask that the commission remain flexible for the full-time employees in order to promote an environment that supports schedule flexibility that will benefit the commission and provide adequate staffing levels during furlough leave, annual and sick leave, eliminate overtime, and be fair and equitable among divisional employees. The schedule flexibility is consistent with the governor's executive order and can decrease employee commuting costs and save on energy consumption, which ultimately improves employee morale.
Questions, comments?
Well, I think the analysis done here is excellent. It certainly recognizes the niche area that we have to operate in with all these statutory effective dates and the necessity for getting our work done in a very specific and shortened frame of time, typically. So I appreciate the work done here.
Mr. Wagner, you got anything?
I got nothing.
Got nothing. Okay. Well, yeah, I appreciate the work done, too. I really think the major issue here is cost savings, and there really are none that are identified by closing one day a week, because we pay for the utilities whether we use them or not on a flat rate, so we're not really saving any money to the state, and the only thing we would be doing would be running at a detriment to the consuming public, particularly with areas like consumer complaint and things like that, as well as putting our own professional staff, I think, in a real bind in terms of carving off days on the deemed approved date. So I appreciate the report, and I go ahead and I just make a motion that we accept the executive director's recommendation.
Second.
Concur.
Item 2E, and 2E, F, and G are for discussion, not vote.
Okay. Item 2E is, I've provided, attached to the briefing memo, fiscal year 2010 financial information summary, and I'd like to also walk through some measures that the commission has taken pursuant to a directive issued by Governor Givens on February 11th. At this time, if you'll look at the attachment, the only major area of concern is Category 01, which is personnel services. The fiscal division is closely monitoring this category, and we may very well have to prepare a work program for the Interim Finance Committee meeting prior to the end of this fiscal year in order to augment this category. The briefing memo before you says by approximately $98,000 to project or for projected shortfalls. However, with all of our positions recently being filled, we have updated projections with respect to full payroll, and that number has now increased to approximately $132,000 shortfall. This shortfall is essentially due to a couple of factors. One, terminal pay totaling $120,000 for employee departures. We had 5 individuals who retired, and we had to pay out sick and annual leave on those. We also were unfunded in this category approximately $128,000 before we started the biennium, and this was with respect to the governor's recommended 6% salary reduction. However, the legislature approved a 4.6% furlough leave, so that equated to the $128,000 shortfall that we started with. Through vacancy savings, though, the commission was able to reduce the shortfall amount from $248,000 to what we projected, $98,000, which is now $132,000. Additionally, I wanted to bring to your attention that the commission's optimal reserve range is between $2.5 million and $2.8 million. Our current projections at fiscal year end, which includes the $1 million reversion that was authorized by Assembly Bill 3 during special session, it leaves the Commission's reserve level at $2.45 million, which is slightly below the optimum. Also, with respect to the measures that the Commission has recently taken in order to save, in Category 01 in Personnel Services, we implemented the hiring freeze. We are now compliant with the required justification to fill critical need positions. So essentially what this means is, in the event of a vacancy, the commission will have to demonstrate the critical need to fill that position, not only to the governor's office, but to the governor's office as well. Recently, a member of the governor's office indicated that a critical need position is just that. Unless we can demonstrate that somebody will be harmed or killed by not filling the position, chances are we will not be able to fill it. And this is regardless of funding source. In addition to that, if the position is revenue generating, so for example, a tax collector, that would probably be a position that they would agree to fill, because there would be a loss of revenue to the state in the event that position's not filled. Also, with respect to overtime, we've eliminated it. All overtime basically will go be addressed to the managers and really should not be worked. If any is worked, it will be brought to my attention immediately. We also had to rescind temporary adjustments to salaries. This is the plus 5%. It did impact three of our employees with the Spanish bilingual skills. With respect to category 02, 03, and 30, that's our out-of-state training, or excuse me, our out-of-state travel, our in-state travel, and our training. We did revise our policy consistent with the governor's directive, and we did eliminate all travel and training that's not related to the core mission of the job. Additionally, just yesterday, there was another revision to the travel policy for incidentals. Incidentals, I believe, is a $3 charge that you can claim. However, it does exclude meals, and it's typically for overnight travel. So hopefully that's been clarified in the new travel policy. With respect to Category 04 operating leases, we were able to negotiate some reductions. Carson City lease, it's 10% for the remaining of the lease agreement, which is through May 31st, 2013. In Las Vegas, we were able to negotiate a 10% reduction, which is effective July 1st through the end of this year. And we may have to see if we can negotiate that further, depending on the implementation of our new lease that we're in the process of negotiating now. With respect to equipment, Category 05, we are delaying the purchase of replacement of two safety vehicles. There is a new schedule that the budget office issued, and replacement vehicles now must be at least 7 years old or have over 100,000 miles on them. So these will be, the purchase of these vehicles will be deferred, I believe, until fiscal year 2011. In closing, we will continue to monitor Category 01 Personnel Services, and I suspect I will report back to you sometime in May with better projections in order for us to proceed through IFC prior to the end of this fiscal year to cover the shortfall that we're anticipating.
You You know, we started out with the unfunded personnel services of $128,000, which represents the difference between 4.6 and 6% that actually hit the agency. And with all the permutations of retirement payouts, we ended up with 132. And I know that's a projection, but I think that's mute evidence of pretty good management, to be quite honest with you. We're just about at the point that we were, not even considering all of the movement that we've had in the payouts, we've had to have exactly what we were funded at. And I would suspect that most, if not all, agencies are facing this, some unfunded personnel cost. So, and the remedy would be to go to IFC at some point, right?
We will have to go to IFC, Chairman.
Yeah, okay.
The most we can transfer is $20,000. And if right. With a projected shortfall of $132,000, we will have to go to IFC. I can tell you, all of the managers have been very accommodating. When we have had positions vacate, we have been able to receive some personnel savings. We haven't filled the positions immediately. We've extended that out 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month, in order to demonstrate, you know, some savings to help offset the projected shortfall. So I think we've done very well in that area.
And I agree. Kudos. Any other questions or comments by the commissioners?
I have just one. I would echo the chairman's comments about good management. I am actually glad to see your recommendation of you bringing that back to us, because I'd like us to kind of stay on top of this, the plus 5% that was rescinded from the three employees of Spanish bilingual skills. I know that kind of bothers all of us. But if there's any chance that we can get that money back to those people as soon as possible, I think we try to do that when it's the earliest possible time we could do it. That would be great.
Understood, and we'd certainly like to put that back in place as well. And unfortunately, until the governor lifts that directive, we don't have a lot of flexibility there.
Sure.
Okay, item 2F.
Item 2F is a policy. This was discussed at our first administrative meeting, and Commissioner Wagner and Stephanie Herrera basically put this together for your review today and any feedback that you'd like to provide. It's with respect to issuing news releases, and I think it's pretty straightforward. I'm happy to go through it with you if you'd like, or we can take any questions that you might have.
Are there any questions by any of the commissioners or comments?
Nobody.
The only thing, let me just say this. Under commissioner responsibility, I like to avoid draconian language whenever I can, and I would do this for anybody, but I think maybe a little softer language there would be more effective with regard to maybe the PEIO consulting with the commissioners, to determine which ones, as opposed to imposing any kind of reviewing and reporting responsibility on the commissioners to make sure that, certainly, my own personal experience, I've had news releases released on a rate decrease due to DEAA. At the same time, I had a general rate case going on, which was pretty confusing to the general public. So this is a wonderful opportunity, and it's a great initiative to sort of streamline that and put that under the control of one person, and certainly Ms. Herrera is the proper person to do that, to sort of manage those. But I think in consulting in a meaningful way with the different commissioners might be a better way of doing it. And certainly that inures both ways, the commissioners and their AAs, in talking and working together with Ms. Herrera. That's just a comment that I had to make.
And, Chairman, I'd like to just respond to that. I totally see what you're saying. And what our intent was there is that sometimes we have dockets that, you know, can provide new information or good news about the commission, and we need to feel free as commissioners to let our PIO know, hey, this might be something of interest to the public, or this is some good news for the commission or about the commission, and so that commissioners have the ability to talk to the PIO directly, rather than the regimes of the past where the commissioners were generally left out of this option. So I agree with the change in your language, is that it's more of a working with the PIO, all of us working with the PIO and you know, consulting on what kind of news releases could be coming from our dockets. So I would agree with your comments.
Well, thank you. I just for clarity, because, you know, by accommodation, really to make the structure work, the commission has placed the PEIO under the auspices of the executive director. There's no law that requires that. We could change that anytime we want to, but it works better to do it this way. But at the same time, we all have to be cognizant that when the Public Education Information Officer issues a news release, they make a news release about what the commission does. And the commission is me and you two. So, you know, we absolutely have to have that dialogue. And if we want a press release issued, then we're going to have that done. It's not really a question of getting that approved or rubber stamped by some other party. So that's why I say in consultation. And if we have to bring it to one of these administrative agendas, we can do that. But, you know, I mean, it has to be that kind of a situation where commissioners have that input. And where we, as Commissioner Wagner says, where we have the largesse to actually be able to reach out and talk to that PEIO directly, which I do and intend to keep doing, as I'm sure you do too, but also for her to contact us and not necessarily go through channels and that kind of thing. I think it's more information and more contact we have, the better it is. But I appreciate the presentation. Anything else? Okay, item 2G.
Okay, item 2G, just want to let you know that we're currently in the process of updating our records retention and disposition schedule. This is for our master files. The retention schedule hasn't been updated since we implemented our electronic filings and records management system in 2006. These modifications are necessary to allow the commission to maintain the master files in the imaging system for a minimum of 10 years or longer if desired, destroy the paper copies of master file documents once quality assurance verification of the images stored in the imaging system is complete, and create microfilm for a full year, once again, that when the closed dockets are verified, and also transfer the microfilm to the state archives for permanent historical retention. After the master file records have been retained in the imaging system for a minimum of 10 years, and they are microfilmed, and the microfilm is transferred to state archives, the records may be deleted from our imaging system. The updated records retention and disposition schedule will be placed on an upcoming agenda meeting for the State Records Committee's approval. I've attached a copy of the changes. Hopefully that's in color for you so you can see the strike-throughs and then the new language. Once approved by the committee, commission staff can proceed with destroying paper copies of master files once they are verified in the imaging system. And the master files will then be maintained and filmed and disposed of in accordance with the new schedule. So I just wanted to bring it to your attention since this does go before the State Records Committee for approval. And hopefully this will start working on some of the files that we had in our Las Vegas office that we've now moved to our Carson office and we're storing in a vacant office up here now.
Well, I'm really happy to see this, and I may want to restyle this the Breanne Brewer Empty the Room Act, because I'll tell you, Ms. Jackson sent the right person down here when we started looking at getting rid of files, and Ms. Brewer came in here with a dustpan and a broom, and we got rid of files. I apologize to Carson City. I think Carson City sent the files here, and now we've sent them back to you. So sorry about that.
Yeah, they're in the office right by mine. Thanks. Just temporarily.
Just put them in my visiting office, and I'll work around them. But this is really well drafted, and I appreciate you doing this, Ms. Jackson. I think it's, and I just think it goes directly, it follows so well the EPHRAM system that you've put in place, there really is no need for us to keep these paper files, and this did come up under our process here. We started talking about paying for design and square footage rental for rooms to store files that we don't need. So This is something that really is a cost savings to the state. We don't have to pay rent storage space for files that we don't need. So thank you for bringing this to us.
Thank you.
Okay. That can.
At the risk of prolonging this agony, I'm sorry. Crystal, if you take a look at the very last document, the recommended changes themselves, the language.
Yes.
I think that the briefing memo is very clear what you're doing, but I'm not so sure that it's translated into this document itself. You've got these records, and these records don't really identify whether we're, I mean, I understand we're doing with the paper versus the electronic, mm-hmm. but there's some disconnect between this language when you're talking about authorized retention, retain these records. I'm assuming we're talking about, at this stage, they're electronic records because the paper stuff has been turned into a scanned document,
mm-hmm.
correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think there's a little bit of a disconnect there with the language, but take a look at it.
I'll clarify the language before we submit it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Retain records.
Yeah, retain records.
Yeah. Okay, that brings us to the, are there any other questions or comments? I'm sorry. Okay, that's the end of the agenda, mercifully, and we're at the miscellaneous portions. If there's any comments by the public, we have managed to run away everybody that was here in Las Vegas, so there's no public comment here. How about Carson City?
There's about 40 or 50 people lined up.
Good. Make sure they fill out a card. And
we're limiting public comment to 5 seconds. No, there's no one coming forward.
All right. Thank you. We're adjourned.
You know the old adage of the brain can absorb only as much as the brain.